Oh, actually, why do the new worlds seem a lot like the old worlds? We're supposed to be growing out of that.
I was going to say, did it really change all that much? I seem to recall that what's old is new again.
Well, the as you obviously it's in the news is the the stuff going on with the boats from Venezuela. One of the astounding pieces of news, well, back in World War I, which none of us were alive for, they had an incident where the idea of naval warfare was you're supposed to pick up survivors, and by the way, you're supposed to have ships that are capable of doing that, and everybody's supposed to bring out their battleships and line them up, and the guys with the biggest one wins. Imagine that. But the Germans invented this thing called a submarine.
Yeah.
Which not only was a problem, but it was didn't have any room for any survivors.
Well, yeah, the biggest problem is you've got 500 dudes on the ship and the sub holds 30.
Yeah. So the first time they nailed somebody, they not only they nailed this ship and all the survivors in the water, and then the other ship came back to pick up the survivors, so they torpedoed that one too.
They sunk that ship.
Yeah. So of course, the Brits run off to the Geneva Convention because every time you get a new piece of warfare, you know, you got to find a way to get around it, right? Well, that didn't work out too well. Plus, World War One was a. I need to do some more study on that someday if I get some time. Of course, I also want to watch this Ken Burns thing on the Revolutionary War. But World War One had an awful lot of issues, meaning gas, meaning flamethrowers. I mean, those kinds of things were all sort of invented. And the best was the. Evidently, there was a rule. By the way, the S&P futures are up 16, Nasdaq futures up 90. We're trying to come back from yesterday here a little bit. We always got to buy the dip, right? Because we were down a bunch yesterday and had to come all the way back. But the issue with you couldn't put gas in artillery shells. All right, so well that's okay, I guess. So they decided, well, if we can't do that. They took a particularly dark night, and they got these losers to take these hoses and essentially crawl on their stomach across the area between the two trenches and drop the hose off but near the other guy's trench without being seen.
Right.
So then
works until you get seen.
Well, yeah, but they picked a moonless night. And
right.
So they did this, and of course they started pumping gas through the hose, which technically was okay because it wasn't an artillery shell. So... But what they forgot about, that when the wind came up, it blew it back toward their lines.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the same, as I pointed out when all the crazy started. The Holy Grail forever in chemical and biological warfare research is to find something that kills the other guy, but when the inevitable happens and it gets your guys, it doesn't kill them.
Right.
Okay. The problem with this in the biological, the bioweapon research realm is that no such thing has ever been found. And so you can exploit natural immunity differences between groups because there's been no contact. I mean, we know this happened, for example, with measles in what is now America, in that the native population had zero exposure to it historically. It had just never gotten here until white man shows up, and as a result, instead of killing one in 500 people, now it's like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2, or 1 or 2 in 1,000 is the current rate for measles actually whacking you, as opposed to you get sick, you get better, you get immunity. however, without today's medical care, that number was considerably higher, right? However, among the Native American population, it was more, the death rate was more like 15%.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, but
here's the thing, Chief, there's a lot of people that think that because you had that kind of stratification that you can extend that and end up with something that kills all the other guys and doesn't get any of your guys, and that has never worked.
Well, plus they didn't realize, as everybody saw this cloud coming of gas, they jumped in the trench, not realizing that the gas was heavier than air.
Right, you go into the trench.
Yeah, the last thing I do is go down in the trench. But
right, because you get the higher concentration.
How did they ever figure out that the when you saw these gas masks, people would wear as his mask, when you say, okay, what does a mask do? It actually filtered the air through a whole bunch of charcoal essentially a back. But how do they find out that charcoal neutralized? What kind of gas were they using? Chlorine gas?
Well, it doesn't neutralize it; it absorbs it.
Okay.
So it's it's the same reason you use a charcoal-based water filter at your house, in that it absorbs the volatiles in particular. I mean, a charcoal filter is primarily a taste and odor thing for water, and it's the chloramines that are left over from chlorination, which of course is kind of important because you probably would not like to get a waterborne disease. But those chloramines taste like hell, and so even in very small amounts, so the charcoal filter gets that out of there. And it works on air too. Of course, it works up until it runs out. Right, when it's full, it's full. So there is a problem in that if you get gassed to a substantial degree, it's your filter's going to fill up, and then oops. And there were two. There were basically two kinds of agents that were developed in World War I. One was, for all intents and purposes, the same sort of thing as, it's just either chlorine or ammonia, both of which are really nasty. But the second was a blistering agent. Those were really bad.
Yeah, those touch the skin. Those mess with the skin.
Yeah, those were really nasty. And if inhaled, the way you died from them was really horrible.
Well, my aunt from Britain, God, she's absolutely terrific. She went through the Blitz in London.
Yeah.
And she and her mother slept in the bomb shelter in the backyard, and the old man and a brother slept under the dining room table, which evidently was pretty substantial. How'd you like to sleep for like 3 years under the dining room table with your dad?
I think that would suck pretty bad, to tell you the truth.
Or I'm not so sure I'd really want to be in a bomb shelter either.
Well, I don't think either of them are particularly good, right?
They used the subways. They used everything for bomb shelters. But yeah. her father, somehow, he got gassed in World War I. I never met him. He lost a lung. How the hell did they take a lung out in like 1920? I can't imagine that surgery. They probably had ether, though, didn't they?
Well,
maybe.
All I can tell you is that the operating rooms in hospitals used to be on the top floor, and the reason was so you couldn't hear the screams from the street.
Well, somehow or another, the dude lasted pretty long. And I always kind of wondered, not that I was happy for him, I guess, why only one lung? Why was pull one out and the other one was okay? One got damaged more than the other, but it did. The dude lasted, into his 60s, I guess.
Yeah.
With one lung, but anyway, these wars are pretty nasty. But having said all that, what is going on with our Bitcoin? It's up 2,000 this morning. Are we buying the dip? Of course, your buddy Tom Lee, Mr. Bull, says that the amount of cash piling up to buy it at 75,000, guys can't even go to the can because they're tripping over $100 bills.
Come on.
Yeah, basically.
Here's the basic problem. And I'm sure Sailor's out there saying the same thing, Mr. MicroStrategy. Here's the basic problem you have with all of this. What apparently set off this latest sell-off, and I don't know if it actually started it or it just made it as deep as it was, is that somebody managed to figure out how to tamper with the chain of custody stuff in Ether. Now,
okay, all right. Before you go into that, is every one of these mechanisms the same?
No, and yes.
Okay.
Okay. So, it's not as simple as a yes or no question, but all of them, however, rely on the same basic premise, which is that you publish, essentially, that a transaction has taken place, and that transaction is signed. It has a digital signature on it. Okay, now, we all use this every time we engage in any kind of electronic commerce. Anytime we log into our bank, you buy something on Amazon, whatever, we all use this technology every single day, okay? And the premise is that there is a published key half that everyone has access to, and there is a second key that's matched to it, that's the private key half that nobody has except one end. And the nobody has part is really, really important, because if somebody gets their hands on it, they can impersonate the other end, okay?
Which I think is somewhere along the line probably going to happen, but that's just me.
Well, but that's it, if it's detected, it's changeable, so it's not, you know, it's not the end of the world, right? The risk is, of course, when you don't know that it's been stolen. The thing is that basically the way it works is that when I encode something using one of those two key halves, it is then not readable by anybody without using the other, including myself. So if I encrypt a message to you using the public part of a key, then I can't read it anymore, and neither can anybody else, but you can, because you have the private, you and only you have the private half. Okay, if you send something to me using the private half, anybody that has the public half, which is published, can see it and read it. However, they know factually that you issued it. You can't repudiate it. You can't say, I didn't do that, because your private key is only held by you. So the only person that could have possibly encrypted that message is you, because if anybody else did with anything else, the public key doesn't decode it. So that's the basis of how all this works. So when you do something with the cryptocurrency, you publish that, and it is signed with that key. Everybody, then it goes into the system.
All right, so break this down to the basics.
Right.
You buy a set of tires from me, and I want to pay you in Bitcoin.
Right.
What happens?
Okay. You submit this transaction into the system. So the tire seller, I go to sell you the tires. I, quote-unquote, collect your Bitcoin.
All right, so you have to be set up in the system somewhere.
Yes. And I, whether it's through an, now if I'm a merchant, it'd probably be through an exchange, because I'd be kind of crazy to be doing it myself. All right. But once I put that, you know, just like if you're a merchant, you probably have a bank account, right? Same thing, you know, a Visa terminal. All right. So I publish that transaction, whether I do it personally or I do it through an intermediary like an exchange. That transaction then has to circulate to the other entities that also do the verification. Now, in Bitcoin, that's the miners, the people that are actually doing the mining. Part of their tasks is to validate transactions that come through the system and become added to this blockchain, which is just in, you can't overwrite it, but you can append to it, so you can add to the end of it. So what they have to do is chase every transaction that has been signed from when that particular coin or fraction thereof, so whatever its origin was, all the way back to its origin, and check every single signature. They all must validate. If they do, then they add your transaction to the end of the chain. And after some number of entities all do this, then the transaction is considered good. Okay, so
then you end up with half a Bitcoin for the tires.
So I end up with half a, you know, whatever. Well, it would be a little less than half, I think, at this point. But yeah, but I end up with that fraction of the Bitcoin.
You're a hundredth of a Bitcoin for $800 worth of tires.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I now have the hundredth of a Bitcoin, but that transaction is not confirmed and known good until a certain percentage of the entities that are maintaining these lists say that they've chased the transaction all the way back to its origin and it's valid. All right, now what happened recently is somebody figured out how to basically queer the game and stuff a bunch of Ether coins that were false, they were forged, okay, into the list. Now that's not supposed to be able to be done, but it was. It was detected, and because all the other places that validate it were like, hey, what the F is this? This doesn't validate, right? So it got thrown up on. However, the problem with this is that the structure of the system is not supposed to allow that to happen, and it did. So the problem that immediately comes up is that you shake the confidence in the fact that this validation system has been tampered with. Now, they didn't get away with it. Okay, so that's, you know, at least not in a permanent form. But that was a problem. And then the other issue that you have, and I didn't realize that it was this crazy, but you have two things going on from a regulatory perspective, one of which is regulatory, the other is just stupidity. The first one is that people have, for the last several years, been using foreign exchanges because they don't report to the IRS, even though they're U.S. domiciled persons and subject to IRS taxation in the United States. And
back up a little bit, if you don't mind, on the exchanges. I mean, I know how the exchanges work. Obviously, I was on the board of one here, and I understand how the stock stuff. I mean, I'm not Mr. Back Office guy or anything, but I know how the borrowing goes back and forth, and how you essentially give title to your stock. You put it in street name so that place can lend the stock out and so forth, even though it's yours.
Right.
And I kind of understand how that works, although I was never a short stock, maven. How exactly does an exchange get in the middle of all this? I mean, do they end up with your password? I mean, how does...
Well, you essentially have a street name kind of situation with your digital assets that are on an exchange, just like you do with stock that is, is held at Schwab. Okay, or if
yeah, but I know what happens to that. It goes to Schwab, but it's in right. Schwab name, but it's in my account. How right. do I, if I got, if I was...
So say it's basically the same thing, Chief, because otherwise your private keying for your personal digital wallet would have to be disclosed, and that makes it not a secret anymore. Okay?
Right, so I was smart enough, let's take it down to the dumbos like me. If I somehow or another, 10 years ago, maxed out my credit cards and bought 5 bitcoins at 10 grand a piece at one of these ATMs.
And now all of a sudden...
Oh now boy. They're worth... Right. Well, they're worth down from 120. But say they're worth 85, and I want to sell it. How exactly do I do that, either through an exchange or not?
Well,
I can't go to the same ATM and have the thing spit out 400
no,
grand in $10 bills.
Well, you could try that. I wouldn't recommend it. But you could find somebody else that's willing to give you money. Okay.
Or how do I do that?
Well, via whatever mechanism. Okay, I mean, maybe they're going to wire the cash to you. Maybe they're going to hand you $100 bills. And
so I can go someplace and give you those bitcoins in return for whatever you give me.
You can go directly to me and do it.
That's what I'm saying.
But the problem with that is that you and I are going to have to sit in the same room and not consummate that transaction until the verification process completes, and that may take some time.
So it's like Roach Hotel. I check in, but I can't check out.
Well, you can check out. It just takes time for that validation to happen, because otherwise, if I get... Let's say that you sell me this and I end up owing you, $300,000, right? And I wire you the 300 grand. Well, once I send the wire, it's gone.
Yep.
All right. So the problem is I can't do that unless I'm willing to risk losing the money until that transaction is confirmed through the blockchain system.
And once I get it to you, I can't get it back then either.
That's correct. Okay. So there is a period of time.
I'm not so sure I like this.
Well, there's kind of a digital no man's land period of time.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Right. Now, the thing is, if you put this into an exchange, you have to put it into the exchange. Now you've essentially put your Bitcoin into street name, for all intents and purposes. Okay? And
did then... Did the inventors of this thing anticipate that?
Sort of. I mean...
So I go walk into Coinbase, if there's an office, and say, I got 5 Bitcoins, and they say, fine, sign them over to us. Do I give you guys, those guys, my password? I must.
No. You transfer it to them.
Okay.
You deposit it at Coinbase, and it's exactly like taking a physical stock certificate that you used, that you had in your safe from the 1920s or 30s, and it was one of the companies that survived the Depression.
Yeah.
Okay. And you want to cash that at, Schwab or Fido or Morgan Stanley or whatever. You have to give it to them. They have to validate that it's good, all right, and essentially transmute.
Well, you got to go to
the
transfer agent, or
be transmuted into electronic form, because nobody sends out paper certificates anymore.
Well, but they should have been sending you a dividend, so they must. You should be on record someplace.
Well, but the thing is,
assuming you get a dividend,
But Chief, verifying that certificate's good takes some time.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay, and the same thing's true here. The problem, you have two like I said, one of them is regulatory. The IRS has basically said any transaction that can come into the United States is subject to our regulation. And by the way, this has, that you've been asked on your tax return, have you owned any digital assets? It's been on that.
Yeah, I remember that. I just sent mine in. I saw
yeah,
it on there.
It showed up for a while, right? But a lot of people have lied, all right? And they have these things in overseas, and they're thinking they don't got to pay any taxes on the transactions. Well, guess what?
Well, you don't have to mark the market. It's still in a transaction, right?
No. It's just like a stock or a commodity. It's when you buy it, when you sell it, okay? If you buy gold...
If you're a trader, you got to market the market, right?
Well, if you're a professional trader, you have to market the market every year, yeah. You know, just like anybody else.
Yeah.
Professional traders, professional. But for the average schmuck, no. But you had better have the cost basis for, and by God, if you've been dividing this stuff up, and, you know, I'm going to pay somebody $100 here, $100 here, oh, boy, do you have a record-keeping problem.
Well, it's like you're in a dividend reinvestment program for 30 years.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you haven't been keeping track of it, you've got trouble, okay?
Yep.
But then the other thing is that some of these overseas places, I started digging into this a couple of days ago when things got really hairy with the moves in the price. Some of them are allowing 500-to-1 leverage.
That always works. Sounds like tulips.
It sounds a lot like tulips. Now, what happens when somebody gets a margin call overseas?
The same way we used to have people from Mexico doing futures through us. You got to track them down.
Well, what if he ain't got it? And when you get these high volatility moves, okay, and somebody's got crazy, I mean, you know, the gearing at the CME is bad enough, you know, 8 to 10 to 1, right? You start talking about people that are out there with, you know, I have made noise about this kind of craziness in the Forex markets for a long time. All right, because this has been something that has, you know, look, currencies never move more than 1% in a day. So, you know, yeah, 100-to-1 leverage, yeah, you could get wiped out.
Okay, currencies are nasty.
Well, but Forex.
All right, let's back up here. We've been explaining the last couple of weeks some of these stocks that are down a bunch from their highs. Now, that doesn't mean everybody bought them there. Obviously, they didn't. But if you were to bought MSTR at you know, 350, where the hell I got up to. Actually, got up to 4 something. Let's say 350. Your initial margin is going to be 175.
It was at 457. Chief,
okay,
was
so,
the high,
so let's
year.
Let's pick 400 then. This is for round numbers.
Yeah.
You bought it there. If you call up PTI Securities, you know, again, we don't have a lot of people who do this. In fact, we have like nobody that does this. Hey, I want to buy 1,000 shares of MicroStrategy at $400. And we go, okay, well, that'll be 400 cheap. And what's the minimum I can send you? The minimum is 200, because the Fed sets the margin rate at 50,000 or 50%. However, if it starts to go down, you don't have to match dollar for dollar. You don't have to come up with more money until your equity is only 30% of the equity. Your equity is only 30% of the price. So that's got to be what,
right?
320 or something. We got to find you. Now on the futures side, what Carl's talking about, and I'll make an easy one. Say you're buying a contract of soybeans, which is 5,000 bushels, which is essentially a railroad car full. Everything's in railroad cars over there, in case you didn't know that. So that's a railroad car full. So the margin on that might only be $2,000,
right?
You know, if it's steady. Now, if it gets crazy, they can raise the margin. However, that is marked to market. So 5,000 bushels, if it goes down like a dime, it's $500, right? So now you only have 1,500.
Right.
So now we're calling you saying, hey, where's the other 500?
Where's the other $500?
Just
right.
just to make it till tomorrow. If the answer is I don't have it, then we puke it out.
And you just ate the loss.
Yeah, you just ate the loss. But the other side, which works even, I guess, in some ways worse, if the soybean goes up a dollar, now you've got $5,000 worth of equity. You can actually go buy another two contracts. You have enough margin for it. So you have to be really careful that people don't run this up on the way up, or if they're short on the way down, to where all of a sudden soybeans are up $2, and instead of one contract, the guy's got seven.
Right.
You know, now you got a real problem here. But that's what changed after the crash of 29. Crash of 29, it used to be dollar for dollar on the margin. So the minute a stock went down, you had a margin call like that day, no matter what. There wasn't that 20% slippage. But none of that slippage applies in the commodity side of the world. So what Carl's talking about, currencies never usually move until they do. Yeah,
until they do.
Yeah.
and then, oops. Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, shorting calls naked.
Yeah.
Could have the same sort of thing rammed up your back door, right?
Yeah, I think we have Joel, Carl. So
we do.
Joel, Carl.
Morning, Chief.
I don't know about Kenny's calling in, but if you want to hang around, otherwise we'll talk on Friday. Joel, how are you?
I'm doing super, Chief. How you doing on this Tuesday?
All right, your team did not do what you want them to do.
Was any of our listeners? Do you remember what I said last week?
You said you didn't think they were going to win the fourth time or fifth time in a row.
Yep. And I'll just go back. We haven't talked sports in a while. My primary evaluation on teams when in college is how many are going to play on Sunday. And Ohio State had at least five players. I don't know how many are eligible for the draft this year. They're going to play on Sunday. Michigan, at this point, I can't really identify one.
That's a problem.
Ohio State sends two wide receivers in the NFL almost every year. Defensive backs, us, nothing. So just the level of talent is there. Michigan had the youngest team in the Big Ten. A lot of different factors there. I wish I could consistently bet against Michigan. If I could bet against Michigan as often as I short the market, I'd be a very wealthy man.
Well, the thing that surprises me about Ohio State is you'll see, you know, in Alabama used to be kind of like that. There's only a couple teams. You'd have, say, Clemson with a spectacular year. I'm talking 10 years ago. And all of a sudden, guys that they thought they were going to have 4 years, they're four stars, leave after junior year. So if you get seven, eight, or nine guys drafted off your team, most teams are left with, hey, where's the buffet? Everybody's gone. I mean, you have bodies, but you don't have bodies like that. I mean, Ohio State and Alabama seem to be the only two teams that next year wouldn't even have a hiccup. They'd have other guys like that. And, you know, the other teams, even Georgia for a while, they'd have a great team 1 year, and then all of a sudden everybody gets drafted, and it takes them two or three more years to reload. But Ohio State seems to be able to do it every year. What's their secret?
You know what the secret is.
Well, I know, but everybody's paying now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to phrase this. They have a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
To bring in, got to be really carefully the way I phrase this. Different. I'll just say it. Different admission standards is one thing. So,
Are there any admission standards on guys that are shifting every year?
No. But I mean, also, I think more so than that, I think Ryan Day's a very good coach. I think that, you know, they bring in someone like Matt Patricia, who has, you know, tons of NFL experience. So, I mean, I would, you know, I'm not going to have sour grapes. I'm going to say it's talent and coaching.
How much of it is people in Ohio really think that Ohio State is their team? They have a real heads up or leg up on recruiting anybody in Ohio, it seems. I mean, I don't want to know, what's his name? Who's the quarterback that went to Notre Dame for 3 years? He got drafted in the NFL. He's from Dublin, Ohio. Guy, when he left, it was like he was a traitor.
Talking about Joe Burrow?
No, Brady Quinn.
Oh, Brady Quinn. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, playing time. I mean, you know, it's just the way it is. You know, it's a new NFL. You know, the flexibility. But you know what? Old schools have. I mean, look how much Michigan, you know, paid Bryce Underwood. I mean,
yeah,
that's not looking like a great investment right now. So. He really did not. I mean, one thing I was worried about his last game as a senior, he got sacked six times in the high school football championship, And, you know, if you know, like I said, he's a freshman. He's an 18-year-old guy, you know, picking up, you know, picking up the different reads in, you know, the first, second, and third check down. And also, four of our five offensive line were freshmen or redshirt freshmen. So you can make all the excuses you want. You can say injuries. You can say, you know, we were down to our third string running back. But, you know, when it comes right down to it, you know, you got to play the game. And I will be wearing my, I don't know if I have any Indiana Hoosier gear, but we'll see.
It's kind of the same color as Ohio State.
Yeah. Well, they're more like
they're red, more reddish.
Yeah, but I only got a few minutes left. Do you want to talk to any?
Well, yeah, what's going on?
Michigan basketball, just right now. Michigan basketball. Okay, I don't know if you followed those results over the weekend, but they had 230-plus wins over ranked teams.
Whoa.
in this Players Error Challenge. That's the first time that's happened. Since even before we were born, Chief. That's the first time it's happened since the 1948-1949 season. Whoa. So you know what that means? We're a basketball school. We're back to being. We moved up to number 3 in the rankings. So I'm very excited about my Michigan basketball team. I'm happy about that. So I got time for one or two market questions.
What's the story with the cryptos? They got, and how much? What do you? They're down 40% from the highs. That's got to be like $1 trillion loss from the highs now.
More
people bought it. Where is that hurt? And what if it goes lower? Who's on the hook for this? Do you have any idea?
Absolutely not. I will say that it's reached an inflection point in my opinion here, and you know, I like to base my analysis on what I see. And looks like it's trying to put a low in. It's put a, you know, we're only 1 month into the, or 1 day into the month, but it's made a low substantially above the November low. So there's some support in here. So, you know, the answers to your questions, I do not have. But what I can confidently say is that, you know, it's important. It caught a bounce here. I think it's decoupled from the market a little bit here. But you know what? It's just a lot of, you know, when there's getting to be more and more players, and when more and more players and ETFs and the banks and things getting involved, maybe you get a little bit more arb, you know, with the futures. And you know what arbs can do? They can really tighten things up, because they're not looking to make, you know, astronomical amounts of money on, you know, 30%, 40%, 50%. There, you know, if they can pick off an ETF and lay it off on another ETF, laying off in the spot market. So maybe it's just, you know, the increased liquidity that everyone wanted is leading to arbitrage, and arbitrage can kind of put a lid on things until it can. So that's my look on Bitcoin.
That's it. And I just wonder what, you know, I just look at the ones that are on the top of the CNBC chart here. The ones that are trading for like 18 cents. What the hell do you do with those? What do you want one of those for?
Chief, I don't know.
But if I say to you, I got a bunch of these in my pocket, do you want them for your used car? I think you say no. What do we want that for?
The crypto economy. I will say adaptation is the biggest thing, Chief. I mean, when can it be used as a viable currency is what I have to say.
Yeah.
So,
all right, bud. I was jousting with Kevin a little bit about the basketball and football now, but basketball, it kind of bothers me, since I actually think you're supposed to go to school to learn something, that now it's essentially a two-semester sport. They were pretty careful to make it a one-semester sport when I was in school, and you didn't start till December 1st. You had a couple games, and then you didn't have games for 2 weeks in finals, and pretty much you could take, you know, if you wanted to, you could take 18 hours the first semester and 12 the second if you were a basketball guy. Well, now we're starting, what, November 1st? Most people have already played 10 games, right?
Yeah. It kind of was like that before. They always spanned the...
Remember Midnight Madness. It was November 30th.
Yeah. But,
wasn't that long ago. Now all of a sudden, why even go to school? I mean, what's the point?
I agree with you, Chief. I agree with you.
All right, but do we have Kenny? Is he in the room?
All right, thanks, Chief.
All right, take care.
No Kenny yet, but we still have Carl.
You do have Carl, however.
Yeah, I mean, I look at some of these other ones, Carl, and I don't want to get into it, the Trump coins and all the other stuff. Other than the Bitcoin, what is the purpose of these other things?
The same purpose as the Bitcoin, when you get down to it.
All right, so if I say to you, I got a pocket full of Doge coins, you're going to say, so what?
Well, what I'm going to say is that the guys who created the Doge coins took 20% skim off the top, and for every piece of tulip buying and selling that you could manage to con other people into doing, they take that skim on a permanent forward basis. And that, by the way, is exactly the same situation that you have with Bitcoin. It's all the same, and the entire thing is a grift from the top down, because none of these things have a structural design that allows them to actually be a stable store of value. So they're not money, and they never will be money.
They're artificial stack, essentially.
The key word being artificial, because there's nothing behind them. Okay, there's, you know, if you buy a share of GM, you are buying a partial ownership, tiny little piece, but a partial ownership in a company that has a factory down the street that makes cars.
Yeah.
All right. What is the thing that Bitcoin, what are you buying stock in? And the answer is speculative premium, that's all.
No, people are going to say blockchain, which, does anybody own? I know that there's...
No, nobody owns it.
I get it, that's what I'm saying.
Right, the point is that nobody owns it. No, there is no asset per se. Now, are there uses for this sort of thing? Sure. If I want to, let's say, for example, that I want to indelibly document a property transfer, I could do that by having myself have one centillion of a Bitcoin. Okay, the amount doesn't matter. The divisible amount makes no difference. I transfer it to you, and we record that transaction in the blockchain. Okay? Now, by doing this, we have indelibly signed a transaction in a way that is permanently recorded and permanently traceable.
So if I bought a... Burger King was going to do this for a while. So if I bought a Whopper and fries with a Bitcoin, or one thousandth of a Bitcoin, it's a pretty good receipt.
It's a legally admissible receipt.
Okay.
It's not just pretty good. It's actually non-refutable, which, by the way...
But now where do I get the receipt? I
mean, it's published. It's public. Anyone can look it up. So here, of course...
Look it up where?
Online. You could chase that transaction.
Okay. So I can go on there and say, I saw this guy, Carl, even though he says he's a healthy guy getting three Big Macs, I can go find that.
As long as you have my particular account address, yeah.
Okay, well, how would I get that? I wouldn't.
Well, the same way you get it. I mean, how do you get your J.P. Morgan account number? You subpoena J.P. Morgan,
yeah, okay.
Right, or whatever have you. But the thing is, here's the problem. If you bought a kilo of cocaine with me doing this, 20 years later, you could prove I bought a kilo of cocaine.
So why does everybody say it's not traceable? It's just all these other... They do it two or three...
That is a complete lie.
Right, what I'm saying is, you know, I believe you. Everybody else, I guess the question is, you know, it's sort of like if you ask me the question, well, he's got a couple of phantom corporations, I'm going to say, give me a week, give me the books, I'll find them. Because, you know, I'm not a...
Right.
I used to be able to do something. You could, but people don't. And in other words, how difficult is it for me to chase down a Bitcoin drug trade that you did in Europe versus Russia and ran it through Colombia? I mean, how hard is it to do that? I mean, I know it's going to be possible.
Chief, if I've got either end of the transaction, in other words, I have the wallet IDs for either one of them, either end, either the buyer or the seller. If I've got either of those, it's not hard at all. You can go grab a copy of the blockchain right now. Now it's large, okay, but you know, storage today costs nothing, right? And chasing that transaction is trivial.
But I can't find out who did it. I just find a number to the guy on the other end.
Oh well, but as soon as you can tie that, see, this is where people get it wrong. As soon as that person makes a mistake and makes a traceable transaction somewhere that can be tied to a person.
So the day it pops out in cash, you got him.
Well, not only that, you got everything he ever did.
Okay. Ooh.
Okay, that's the problem that people don't understand. You didn't just get the one transaction. You got every transaction. As soon as you can tag somebody with a wallet ID, you've got every transaction that has
but
ever
there's nobody,
taken place.
Here's the issue I had with Kenny, though. If somebody steals money out of some place, you know, whatever it is, could be PTI, it could be Carl's account, we'll find a way to trace it, and we can go from bank to bank to bank. But how do I trace yours? I mean,
you don't even have to go to the bank. You just do it directly within the blockchain. It's all right there.
If I get the numbers. But who do I?
You have to have one of the two endpoints.
All right, so right. If I think, here's what I'm trying to, I'm clumsily getting to this question. If somebody wants your PTI account number and somebody shows up with a subpoena, guess what? We have to give it to them. Who exactly do you serve the subpoena to at Bitcoin?
Well, you don't have to serve a subpoena. You only have to subpoena one of the endpoints, and if an exchange was involved anywhere in the middle that has a KYC requirement, know your customer, God help you, because that's going to be divulged. And again, once I have an endpoint, I can trace everything that person has done.
Okay, but is the exchange, is Coinbase an exchange, or are they just a broker?
No, Coinbase is one of the exchanges.
Okay, so who do they answer to? They're not regulated.
They have an office in the United States that can be subpoenaed.
Okay, so somebody walks in there and said, give me everything you got on this Carl Denninger guy.
Yeah, or give me everything you got on this wallet ID, and it says, oh, that's Carl Denninger. Here's his social security number and where he lives. I had to know your customer when I signed up there.
If I wanted to buy something from you with a Bitcoin, say it's a collector's item Mercedes Benz that happens to be traded for $85,000, which is where Bitcoin's trading.
Okay.
We can go somewhere, the car's in the parking lot, and as soon as it gets approved, you give me the keys to the car somehow. I mean, that's essentially
And I give you the title or whatever.
What if we decide to go through Bitcoin, what's their take? My brother paid 20% at an ATM 10 years ago. I don't think they're paying at 20, are they? What are they taking?
No, well, this is one of the problems, is that there is no Ether has a thing called gas, where basically there's a tax on the transactions to cover the validation expenses. With Bitcoin, it's not done that way. With Bitcoin, it is part of the responsibility of people that are doing the mining to do the clearing. So there is no direct cost. Now, the problem with this is, right now, because of the difficulty, it keeps going up, okay? It now actually costs more than the $87,000 between the hardware and the power to mine a coin. So I now have a situation very similar to what happens with oil on a regular basis. Everybody goes Google Gaga about drilling for oil when it's $100 a barrel, right? Then the price goes to 60.
We have a president who thinks he wants to drill at 60. He's out of his mind.
Well, but the thing is, the price goes to 60, and it costs 80 to get it out of the ground.
every field is different, right?
I understand that, but I'm saying that the problem is, if you're the guy that has an $80 cost of production and it's selling for 60, you've got a big problem, okay? And that same thing has happened to Bitcoin. This is one of the problems that all the proponents have, is that the price is now below the cost of actually mining it, and yet the miners are the ones who clear the transactions. So not only can mining cease, but the ability to clear transactions can cease. And if that happens, you get a collapse.
Okay. Somewhere along the line, there's got to be commission. Who gets it?
Well, there isn't. The guy who mines it, If the cost of mining is below the price that he can sell it for, he doesn't need a commission. He gets paid. Yeah,
I know, but how does
he paid what, 50? It cost him $50,000 to mine, okay, and he got 85.
But where's his return in making sure your and my transaction is legit?
There isn't one. That's the problem.
Okay.
That the problem is he's doing it as part of the task of mining. The problem with this is that presumes the task of mining has a positive return. If it doesn't, why is he doing it?
So, but if I go in and drop my stuff at Coinbase so you can get paid when you want to get paid, Coinbase has to make something somewhere there.
Well, Coinbase, I'm assuming, is making some sort of a spread on the transaction.
Well, that's what I mean, yeah.
I would assume that there is a spread, that there's a bid offer spread at an exchange just like there is on anything else. I mean, they'd be lunatics if there
was. Right, so the sell price is going to be lower than the buy price, like anything else.
Well, you would assume. Yeah. That's what I would assume, yes.
You know, when I used to lecture a real lot, and who knows, maybe I'll get back in the lecture game one of these days, but you kind of lost interest in traveling during COVID, and I never really got it back. But we used to go, you know, the hardest things to talk to people, you know, is how those prices work. You know, it sounds so simple, and everybody, as my brother used to say, everybody's head bobbing and ask a question, see if anybody really understands the hell you're talking about. You ever heard that term, head bobbing? Yeah. Hey, does everybody understand this? Everybody's head goes up and down, and then it goes,
right.
their head bobbing. But I'd say, I put the market down, this is years ago, I'd put the market up there in IBM, and it's 180 to 180 and a quarter, last trade 180 and an eighth. What's the price of IBM? Well, 180 and an eighth. No, it's not.
Right.
What do you mean? Well, what is that? What's trading 180 and an eighth? I said, that's a historical piece of information. Where can you buy it? Well, what do you mean? If you want to buy it right now, it's 180 to 180 and a quarter. What do you got to pay? I don't get what you're talking about. You got to pay 180 and a quarter.
180 and a quarter, yeah, because you yeah. get the quarter.
Yeah, so what if you want to sell it? Well, what do you mean? You got to sell it at 180. Maybe you'll luck out, and just as you go to pay a quarter, some other guy runs out to sell it at 180. Two brokers meet in front of the specialist, and you might cross the trade at 180 and an eighth, but I wouldn't count on it. Actually, yeah. It used to happen about, to be honest though, Carl, it used to happen like 30% of the time.
Oh, I know. And you know, everyone now says, oh, there's no commission. Oh, that, yeah, okay.
Well,
people work for free. Yeah, right.
Well,
sure they do.
That's the thing. The when you know, boy, here, I'll give everybody a little bit of a history lesson. You know who invented payment for order flow?
Oh, God. No, I don't know who the person
All right,
was.
Think of the biggest knave in the last 20 years in the business.
What, Madoff?
Yeah.
Oh, why am I not surprised?
So,
Chief, everybody, you know, everybody says, I mean, you look at what we just had. We just had, you know, Black Friday and then you know, Cyber Monday, right?
Yep.
35% off. Yeah, what they didn't say is they raised the price by 35%, you know, 2 weeks ago. I mean, there's... And by the way, that happens to be illegal, and yet you see it all the time. Nobody ever, and really what it comes down to is nobody ever goes to jail, right? Because the thing is, it is actually law under consumer, you know, deceptive consumer practices, that if you do that, if you placard something like that, you have to have had actual retail sales within the last 30 days at the higher price.
Well, What ended up happening, I guess I could take 2 minutes for this, even though we always have better stuff to talk about. The only person that could actually take down, because we were a specialist on the Chicago Stock Exchange for a little while, the only person that could actually take the offer or hit the bid on another exchange was a specialist on a competing exchange. So what Bernie Madoff did is he bought a whole bunch of seats on the Cincinnati Stock Exchange, which ended up essentially folding and becoming a computer in the basement of the CBOE. And the CBOE owned essentially the Cincinnati Stock Exchange, but that wasn't exactly correct either, Carl, because if an exchange bought another exchange, say there were 500 seats there, and the CBOE bought 495, right, that only gave you one vote.
Yeah.
And Bernie Madoff had the other five seats, or 10, or whatever the hell he had.
Yeah.
So what he would do is he would say, if the market is 180 to 180 and a quarter in IBM, he would guarantee you the New York bid and offer, and he would rebate you a penny a share for sending it to him instead of New York. Now, you could say to yourself, well, what's the problem with that? My commission is going to go down because the brokerage firm is going to get some money back. Competitively, it would go down a little bit, right? So it's going to go down a little bit. This is great for me. But then I'd say, wait a minute. 36% of the time, you do better than the New York bidder offer. And right. At that time, the minimum tick was an eighth, so it was 12.5 cents. So if 30% of the time, 35% of the time was essentially a third, you lose the 4 cents expectation of doing better, and so Bernie can get paid a penny. So essentially, right. is a three, because Bernie essentially made the 3 cents. He's paying a penny, but he's picking up the difference in the middle. And to try and have that conversation with people, what do you mean my commission's cheaper? Or it's free. It's not free. You're giving up 4 cents to get one.
Right. It's absolutely not free. Yeah.
And I would always just stop the argument because I couldn't get anywhere with it. Nobody had any idea what I was talking about.
Yeah.
What do you mean it's free? It's. I mean, this Audrey had this. The family happened to be Greek. Boy, great chow. So they bought this house, and of course, this huge family's there. And I'm talking to the old man who's, I'm still 6'2", and he's like 5'2". So it was an interesting conversation. He found out I was a trader on a trading floor, and of course, he's on me all night long. And a nice guy. He's talking about he does through Robinhood and everything's free. And I said, I forget what the guy's name was. I said, you've owned restaurants, you've done this your whole life. I said, who exactly is your customer? Is it the person who pays you? And he goes, well, absolutely. I said, well, if you don't pay him, who's the customer? He looked at me and he goes, now I get it.
Right.
The guy who's paying him is the customer. I said, ding, ding, ding.
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, exactly.
Well, so what, all right, we're probably going to have Hal here in a minute. What, where is the person, it's my, you love doing this because you love doing it. It's my job to worry for people so they don't have to. Where do I have to worry about somebody owning, whatever, the QQQ or the Spider or all the different stocks we have, the XLV, a lot of people in there. When do I have to worry that someplace, somewhere, if Bitcoin reaches 40,000, there's going to be some bank, there's going to be somebody I never heard of that gets it stuck up the behind, and all of a sudden it causes a problem?
Well, I think it's already there because, again, the price today is below the cost of production, and not by little, okay? And yet that infrastructure
how did people were mining when it was 20 and making dough? How come all of a sudden they can't make dough at 80?
Because the difficulty goes up over time as you have fewer coins left. So the factoring becomes more difficult.
Okay.
Now there is an adjustment that can be put on that, and
but by who?
Well, it's a polling process, so it's by who is the question, because there is no central control. Okay.
That we know of.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you kind of have to look at that from that perspective. But there is one. The thing is that it's not going to happen instantly. And the other problem that you have is that with the leverage that's in, especially in these overseas exchanges, where nobody's regulating anything, you don't know who's naked and underwater right now to a substantial degree. How well is that being policed from a margin point of view? Are there exchanges that could potentially blow up? The people that have their Bitcoin and street name in those exchanges are going to lose all of it. It's going to be gone.
Now, when you say overseas exchanges, I don't know that much about regulation, but I would say the UK, France, German regulation is better than ours.
Okay, now do Singapore.
Okay, that's what I want to know. Who are you talking about?
That's the thing, is that there's plenty of places where, maybe there isn't any, right? That means anything. The other problem you have right now,
I would guess Singapore probably has some, actually.
Well, yeah, Singapore's actually probably a bad example, because they thought it was being pretty stable. But the other thing to take into consideration is that I suspect, but can't trace, that the yen carry has gotten wound up in this money chase with Bitcoin.
It has to have somehow.
Well, if it has, given what's happening with the JGBs, I would be really careful, because at some point that trade unwinds. And we are in that danger zone right now where the spread on that financing no longer looks like it's going to make a lot of sense. And if that thing comes apart in a violent sort of way, you're going to see every asset get.
Okay, well, again, we talk about this stuff, I'm sorry for keeping backing up because I just want to. I don't want to lose people. The carry trade is the difference in the interest rate in Japan versus here. Now, the carry trade, I mean, Japan is up to 1.9, yes. And the Bund is only 2.7. It's not like Japan was zero and the other guys were two. I mean, is the carry trade as big a factor now because as Japan interest rates have gone up?
Yeah, it is because it's still there, and part of the problem is that we in the United States, to a large degree, did this after the 08 crash, the Dodd-Frank changes and everything else.
What a horrible bill.
Well, you know what? It screwed all the smaller businesses because the larger guys that have, you know, they have formal ratings on their bonds essentially have a zero haircut when they turn them for financing, whereas the little guy that doesn't have that and wants to borrow money, the financial institutions are all of a sudden reserve constrained because there's no formal reserve rate anymore.
Okay, but the Dodd-Frank didn't do what's Hal's always talking about. It's like a separate bill, or actually, it's a thing that Greenspan did. That was not part of Dodd-Frank, was it? To get rid of the reserves and go to this capital thing.
It was all part of a coordinated effort by people in the banking system during the time of the crash.
To make it so that they get everything, basically.
Essentially, the result. So Bernanke stuck one sentence in the bailout bill that ultimately passed, in the TARP bill that passed. I flagged it at the time. It was the one that allowed the
Federal
Reserve.
Okay, but that was separate from Dodd-Frank.
Yes. However,
it was all part of the same stealing, for lack of a better term.
I don't think it was actually separate at all. I think there was a lot of backroom wheedling and deedling.
Right, but if you read Dodd-Frank, it would not be in there.
It's not in the Dodd-Frank bill. Yeah. It was in the TARP bill.
Right.
And it allowed the Federal Reserve to set the reserve ratio at banks to anything, including zero.
Which is nuts.
Which is absolutely flat out insane, and I called that at the time before it was passed that this was crazy. I wrote an article about it. And I said this is insanity. This is going to be ridiculous. So what ended up?
I'm keep doing this. What it means is if one of the listeners or Kyle or me, God, what is this lump on the bottom of this mattress I just bought? If you pull out $100,000 in hundos and you dump them in the bank can turn around and lend the whole $100,000 to Ricky tomorrow. It used to be there was some sort of a reserve on that, and now there isn't. But now there's all these kind of weirdo capital requirements on the bank itself that really have nothing to do with deposits and cash, which is kind of crazy to us.
Yeah,
is that explained properly?
It's basically and so as a result, interest on excess reserves and haircuts on lending on the assets owned by the bank, because a loan to the bank is an asset, okay, from the bank's point of view. Those became the policy levers. The problem with this is that the larger corporations that have the better credit ratings are the ones who have the lower cost of financing, and not by a little. All right, for the larger guy, he in some cases has a 10 times cheaper cost of financing in real terms. Because it's just simply access.
But
if I'm a bank and I don't have to haircut Apple's notes, but I do have to haircut yours by 10%, who do I make the loan to?
But you also, when you say haircut, it means the bank, if they were to lend $1 billion to you and me,
he has to hold it back.
Well, they also need more capital.
That's exactly right.
Right. They need more equity on the balance sheet to be able to do that than if they lent the $1 billion to somebody who allegedly has a higher credit—not really a credit rating, but it is a credit rating, a higher rating. It's not the same kind of credit rating as you and I have, but it's a rating, which is sort of insane. You know what? The weird part of it is, Carol. I was actually, I took money in banking in a graduate level at Notre Dame, and I took a whole bunch of it. I don't understand any of this capital stuff. I'd have to go back as a freshman, for God's sake. If you went and took a class on money and banking now, is this all this new stuff in the class?
I don't know. I mean,
that's a question for Hal, I guess.
You'd hope, but maybe it ain't. Yeah, I think that's a Hal thing. Which, by the way, is perfect because it's about his time, isn't it?
Yeah. Do we have him?
Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up, man? We have all kinds of questions for you. If I took a money and banking class, Am I going to learn all about these capital requirements, or am I going to go back and still learn reserve requirements like I did?
Well, it's been, I think last time I taught money in banking was, and looked at a textbook, was like 2018. So it was before the March 2020 changes. The March 2020 changes is where M1 basically became M2, and they stopped publishing, the Fed stopped publishing a series that showed the total cash and checking account balances that the top 1% had. I think that was roughly about the same time. And then the other thing they stopped publishing was they got rid of excess reserves, and now everything is just total reserves.
All right, and then so if I have a money and banking book up on my library at home, I might as well take it and use it for starting the charcoal fire.
Yeah, I honestly, I haven't looked at the money and banking textbook in such a long time. But I know the macro books, I think the macro textbooks that we teach freshmen is still teaching that old narrative about how the Fed lowers rates by purchasing securities, which is just ridiculous.
Well, they also can move the price floor. Their biggest hammer used to be to change the reserve requirement. Now they don't do that.
Yeah. Well, the reserve requirement was frozen from about the early 1990s until they essentially got rid of it. They zeroed it in 2020.
It was considered the absolute draconian thing to do. It was 21% for, 40 years?
I always describe a change in the reserve requirement as like taking a jackhammer to an archaeological dig. You just didn't want to do it.
You know what? I would do that right now, you know? And I don't know if Carl's still with us. I'd make the reserve requirement tomorrow 5% or 10%.
Yeah. Well, right now, the perverse incentive is for these big, huge banks to make only loans to the highest quality credit, which means they choose their own reserve requirement. I call that that chosen reserve requirement as the desired reserve ratio, what they kind of feel like they need to have on reserve in their bank. And if you're lending to like the ultra, if you're lending only to corporations and high money people who have the most pristine credit and the most incredible ability to pay it back, then you can choose essentially your own reserve requirement ratio, which I call the desired reserve requirement ratio. Desired reserve ratio. You can choose it to be as low as 1%, 0.1%. You don't have, just as long as you meet the credit requirement, you can have that as low as you want. Now, if the economy starts going south, what will happen is, you know, they'll voluntarily hold more reserves. But until that happens, they can have, as long as they meet their capital requirement, they can have almost nothing on reserve, which is freaking scary. Which is why we see, why we were seeing those huge increases in M2.
But you don't have. I mean, you still have. If you work it through, and I don't want to get too technical here, because a lot of listeners tell me don't ever dumb it down, so I won't. If you always needed some capital, but let's start from the beginning. If Carl walks in with the 100 grand he's found in his mattress and drops it in. It used to be they could lend out 80,000 of that. Then if that person dropped it back in, it's 64. But still, if you lost money on the $80,000 loan, you still owed Carl the 100 grand. So so you still, the losses never came out of somebody else's stuff. It was more of a cash thing than it was anything else. I mean, if there was a loss someplace, it still came out of the bank's capital, correct? So there is some logic to going to a capital type of requirement instead of a reserve requirement. I think the thing
is, but a capital requirement, it sets up that really perverse incentive where you don't want to loan to small businesses. You don't want to make operational loans. You don't want to make
plus it's too much work business
loans, because that is really intensive in terms of labor.
Yeah, it's too much work.
You want to have very few. This goes back to that. It's not just unique to the Nazi economic policy. I know this to be the case because I read through Nazi economic policy. They wanted a few large cows because having a bunch of chickens, a lot of small businesses, is harder to manage that economy. Just ask Rocky Balboa.
What do you think, FINRA, when they come and give us an audit, would they rather have 5 Merrill Lynches or 100 PTIs?
They don't want 100 PTIs.
No, God. Yeah.
So that's the problem. And that's one reason why my brother-in-law and his cohort of recent graduates, are having such a hard time finding work, is because These loans aren't going to small businesses.
Do you have any idea that the let's say we lend $1 billion to Amazon, all right, and there's some capital number in there. Well, if we say, all right, they don't want the loan anymore, we're going to lend $100 million apiece to 10 other people that aren't quite as high up the chain as Amazon, does my capital double, go up 10%, 20%? Does anybody have an idea what the degree of this is?
Well, if you look at just small businesses in general, I think the capital ratio is 100%. But if you look at like high quality credit to like billionaires and these corporations,
Carl's still with it. So if I lend Carl's hot dog stand 100 grand, I better have 100 grand in capital if it's a startup.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you have a fairly decent probability you're going to lose the whole 100.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm not going to be able to pay you, and then, you know, that's a zero, right? But yeah. the thing is that the problem with this is when you look at where innovation has actually come from in GDP expansion over time in the economy, it's not from Amazon.
No.
Right? It's from Carl's hot dogs. Yeah.
It's from Carl's hot dog stand that suddenly becomes a multi-billion dollar business.
Yeah.
And goes from having, you know, one dude behind there cooking hot dogs, all of a sudden I got, you know, all of a sudden I'm Portillo's all over Chicago.
What? Yeah. How much of it you think?
In a banker's perspective, I don't want a bunch of loan officers servicing all these loans and making all these loans. And, you know, I don't want that. I want like a few guys servicing these large corporations. And that just sets up a perverse situation where, you know, these massive corporations with just all kinds of wealth and power are getting these loans. And then the bank has this incentive to hold very little in reserve. And where that money ends up at is it ends up in loans to the financial non-depository financial institutions.
See what happens, Carl, when you got a smart guy on. That was going to be my next question. What do you suppose if we, the three of us, as they say in the South Side, if we open up a little bank, you know, near a train station, say, and everybody comes
we'll
in,
we get crushed.
No, we wouldn't. I mean,
we get crushed.
I mean, we get deposits immediately because all the little old ladies would love us. They'd come in, especially if we came from the bank that just got bought out somewhere. We'd get deposits basically out to behind. Now, for a while...
Yeah, but I think we'd have to pay a higher savings rate.
Well, I know two banks that just did this. So, I mean, it happens. And, as a matter of fact, one of them just got sold. But the other one built a big building and is now a big bank, or a decent-sized regional bank, decent-sized local bank. But, okay, so we're going to get a bunch of people dropping money. Trust me, you know, if we got Carl being the greeter, we're gonna get people in there. So all of a sudden we, you know, we're putting our money with the Fed, and we're gonna have, you know, all the big banks come by and say, how about buying a little piece of all these loans? So we're gonna do that kinds of stuff. And all of a sudden one day we go, you know what? We are a neighborhood bank, and there's all these plumbing companies, electric companies, there's these contractors, there's all kinds of people here that need loans. What do you suppose the investment is in just people and software and all the other stuff to have essentially a loan department? It's got to be 5-6 people that you buy. You hire from somewhere else that know what the hell they're doing. That's a big investment, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, in one of my MBA classes, I had students take a modified machine learning algorithm, and it was originally designed to read in biological data. And we modified it so that instead of reading that biological data, it read in thousands and thousands, I think like 40,000 observations from the bank loans in a Boston bank. And we basically created an algorithm that would decide on whether an applicant with various different, you know, attributes, income, family composition, whatnot, married, not married, whatever, male, female, all those different attributes, we developed this algorithm that approved or disapproved or referred the loan to a human for further review. And when we validated it, it was about 91% accurate according to what humans were doing. So we basically outsourced all these loan officer jobs to an algorithm.
Wow.
And it performed really well. I mean, you could have an algorithm do that, or you could pay, you know, five people to make the loans, right? And, you know, you got to calculate the cost of paying all those people versus maybe the small bad decisions that the algorithm produces. And maybe the algorithm, the reason why it's 91% is because maybe the algorithm does a better job than the humans, right? And the humans have an error rate of 10%. So,
well, it kind of depends on when I was.
You and Carl could start the bank, and then I'll run my algorithm, and I'll be in charge of the loan officers, and I'll just use my algorithm.
I go, who did we lend a loan to? I have no idea. The algorithm did it. Carl and I were sitting there having a beer. You don't even know who the hell you loaned it to. What's the matter with him? Oh, what do you mean? My algorithm. First National Bank of Evergreen Park was like the epicenter.
Or would you say yes to all loans like in the movie Yes Man?
Yeah. Well, those guys lent me. I financed a car there. I bought a car for my stepfather. And I did something else. And my parents had a car loan there or something. And all of a sudden, one day, I said, you know, I'm kind of in this construction business. And the guy goes, well, you know, we have these credit cards coming out. I don't really want to do that. He goes, how much you need? I go, 10 grand should be plenty. Well, you'll have it this afternoon. I mean, the guy just said, okay. But I don't think anybody wants to do that anymore, do they?
Yeah.
I mean, what I pay? It was a 6-month loan at like 8%. So what'd they make? $100, $200 on the deal.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you know you're doing stuff for clients. I mean, but they don't. Nobody does that anymore, do they? I mean, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah.
Just apply for a $20,000 credit card and pay 20%. Well, that. Yeah. How am I going to pay 20% and compete against somebody paying 5%?
Well, in my macro class, students are like, well, you don't want to... I'm trying to relate... This is a macro class to 190 freshmen who are not going to be econ majors for the most part. And my whole... I'm trying to help them understand how the system really works so they can either, you know, rail against it, or they can use it to their advantage and grow wealth. And I keep telling them, look, you got to sow the seeds. You sow the seeds.
What is it? Is this
grow wealth?
Is this econ for jacks, like racks for jacks with geology?
No, this is just like econ for like non-business, non-econ majors. It's a big, huge, massive section. And I think maybe one or two of them might be econ majors.
All right. I'm going to ask you.
Most of them are not econ majors. And it's just it fulfills a university-wide general ed credit, right? So they're taking this class, and they don't want to be there because they're not majoring in econ. So I'm trying to make it fun. I'm trying to, you know, tap into that rage people are feeling regarding this.
How much of that, I'm going to ask you guys, I mean, there's no answer to this question, but Hal, you maybe, what is wrong? You can't lead the witness like that. What is your judgment of the economic, financial knowledge of the general population, right? You see some of the stuff flying by on TV.
I think it's very, very low, and I think it's by design. Well, I think it's just a result of the public education system and parents not knowing.
How much of it is not lack of education or just the economy's been this way for 20 years, meaning in terms of interest rates? And I was having a adult beverage the other night, and of course I get crowded by five people wanting to sit at the same table. And they started ragging basically on Kelly's settlement package down in LSU. From what I understand, you know, I could be off by something. They owe Kelly essentially $8 million a year for 7 years. Mm. So if you do the math, it's $56 million. It's actually $54.5 million. I don't know if they weren't going to pay on this year, whatever the deal is. Say it's $56 million.
Yeah.
And they were going to pay him, you know, $40 million or something, or $30 million or whatever it was. And now Kelly's suing for like the whole amount. So we're sitting there at the table, and one guy goes, I can't believe that they're fighting the guy, just pay him the whole amount. And I said, okay, how much is the whole amount? It's $56 million. I said, no, it's not. I said, they're fighting over the interest rate. And five people that are in the business, this business, look at me like I got four heads, and maybe I do. What the hell are you talking about? I said, it's an interest rate. They owe him $56 million. I said, no, they don't. They owe him $8 million in 7 years. That's not $8 million today. The look on everybody's face, it was like I shot him. What are you talking? I said, if I want to give you $8 million 7 years from now, which I don't want to, by the way, I don't have to pony up $8 today. I go to somebody, and if it's 3%, 4%, whatever it is, I'm going to give them $6 million because that's what it's going to be. It'll now be $8 million in 7 years. You just sworn that I farted in church, for God's sake. Nobody had any idea what I was talking about. These guys all got a couple of them were lawyers. I mean, they had no idea what I was talking about. How can that even be?
Yeah. Well, I was at an econ conference, and I was talking about how it was in my early research where I looked at the welfare reforms of 1996 and how it limited people to, like, 5 years of benefits. But because states weren't sharing data in places like Vancouver and Portland or Lewiston, Idaho, and Clarkson, Washington, border, you know, separated by a border, one community separated by a state border, you know, you could literally move from Lewiston, Idaho after you did your 5 years on, you know, TANF, and then go to Clarkson, Washington, do 5 years there. You could do the same thing in Portland and Vancouver. And this really smart guy with a PhD, I don't remember his name, but he goes, I got a PhD and my wife has an MD degree, and we wouldn't have thought of that. Why would a person who's dropped out of high school, how could they come up with it? And I go, well, it's because it's their career. Do you know anybody that's enrolled in these kind of programs? Because I grew up with them. My family was on them. And people figured out pretty quickly how to, if they have been on a public assistance for 10 years and the rules change, they're going to get together and figure out how to remain on it. That's just the reality of it. You don't know anything about this at all because you've never enrolled right in a program. So that's one of the problems is we have very smart people who are hyper experts in this very tiny corner of knowledge. And it happens, it's even worse on college campuses, right? You don't have general economists at these large R1 universities. They are hyper-focused in these little niche areas, and they publish in the niche journals. And when you go to one of their presentations, they're using a completely different language. And I think what it does is it puts them in kind of a silo where they could be making a bunch of mistakes, theoretically, or, you know, just making mistakes. But there's nobody there in that little niche to challenge them. And that's one of the problems is we become a society of hyper experts, and we think because we have a PhD behind our name that makes us an expert in everything. It actually makes us pretty ignorant in things we don't study, but we have that PhD and it gives us kind of a God complex, and that is a lot of it, right? And that's why I think you're feeling that, Tom.
Well, we also tell you what, when you have a bunch of clients, everybody thinks they know everything about trading.
Yeah,
and the smarter you are,
when you're an economist and you teach statistics and economics for a living, everybody knows more than you.
Oh yeah. they all figure, you know, it's I always thought that the more
if they watch, you know, Fox News or MSNBC, they know a lot more than you.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's what they hear on those channels.
Well, I always thought that if the more you end up knowing, the more you realize you don't know.
And exactly.
You learn something every day.
It's humbling. It's humbling.
To be honest with you, why do you think I love doing the show?
Yeah.
I learn something every day from you guys. How many after high school or college? How many people can say that?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
that's why I enjoy working at a university because I'm asked to teach a new class next semester. I'm teaching public finance. I never taught it before. I get to teach it, so I get to learn a bunch of new stuff. I this semester I taught history of economic thought for the first time, and you can't believe how much I've freaking learned. It is just unbelievable. I love it. I freaking whenever my chair asks me to teach something new, I go, yeah, give me more.
I would recommend, and I don't know where this stuff is. I'll see if I can find some here. Maybe I can scan it to you. I would recommend looking at some of the works of George Stigler if you do a public finance class.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what he got his Nobel Prize. And I have a question for you. I have one of his pamphlets here. And he was talking about, you know, monopolies versus regulation. And we talk about switching topics. Paul Harvey, page 2. And 3 minutes. 3 minutes. We're going to break. We missed the first break, but he talked about, you know, when you give somebody a monopoly like you know, gas company or electric company, that type of thing, then you have this regulatory bureau, and he did some kind of a study. Now, how the hell he did it, I have no idea. But he claims that over a period of like 50 years, and I actually would debate him pretty big time on this. He said at the end of 50 years, he thought the prices were at the exact same spot without the regulators or WIF. They just ended up being monopoly pricing. And I think he probably would be right on that. I think, though, that they probably delay it somehow. I mean, we just had a big increase here in the electric company again. And the news on WBBM, which is the news radio, they came out and said, well, there's going to be this big increase in your electric bill, but it's nowhere near as bad as it could have been. The electric company wanted, $370 million, and the state fought them tooth and nail, and they ended up almost directly down the middle. They ended up getting a $185 million price hike. Now, George Stigler would have said, you know what? They wanted the $185 from the get-go, so they threw the $370 in there as a stalking horse, and all these people put all this sweat equity, and they got right back to where they was going to be in the first place.
Oh, I agree with that 100%.
And I don't know how you... And by the way, you're agreeing with a Nobel Prize winner versus me.
I agree with that 100%.
But now...
That's how you make a deal, right? When you go to buy something from some guy that advertised on KSL.com, Utah's Amazon.com, you go over to their garage, you look at the refrigerator that they're selling in their garage because they bought a new one, and you go there with an idea that you want to find that person's lowest willingness to pay, and that person's trying to figure out what your highest willingness to pay is, and then you meet somewhere in between, and neither one of you figured out what that is. So all that utility company is doing and saying, hey, I know we're not going to get, we want 180, but if we offer these, these bureaucrats 300 million, they're going to give us the 180. So they walk in leveraging crazy. That's what Trump does. He leverages crazy because the crazy is not what he really wants. What he really wants is where it ends up being. That's what I said about the tariffs. He doesn't really want 45% or 100% tariffs. He wants, I think, 10 to 15%.
I think he's close to the point where he is the crazy. I don't know. I hope he's letting
him. But that's what he does. That's what business people do. They leverage the crazy to get what they want.
All right, I'm not going to disagree with you or Professor Stigler, since he's wearing a Nobel Prize and I'm not.
Now, let me tell you this, Tom. If energy wasn't regulated, and there was only one company supplying the energy in the form of traditional electricity through your electric plug, and they were charging a monopoly price, that'd be really painful for a couple of years. But there would be an entrepreneur out there going, hey, I'm going to develop a self-contained nuclear reactor. I'm going to sell it to people, and I'm going to test it and make sure it's not at all dangerous. You would have incredible innovation.
Well, okay.
And that monopoly price would be knocked down pretty quick.
So what I'm saying, how do I, if I, other than debating you for the show, if I happen to agree that they're going to go in for higher and go lower, how do I know exactly what their mentality was? Even though I think I have a clue, like you do,
I'll
and
tell
like
you,
he did.
Experience
but
and history tells you what's going to happen, right? If you just watch really good negotiators negotiate, what do? They want the if you watch Wings on the old Wings TV show about the brothers running the airport out of Nantucket, right? Sandpiper Air. When Lowe goes in to negotiate a salary increase, he asks for some really ridiculous things, like a Ferrari or something, or a Corvette, right? He just asks for Antonio, the taxi cab driver, is telling him to do this. And he ends up leaving his job and end up working as a mechanic at the Boston airport, which he hates, right? But all you got to do is watch Wings or read
we got to go to break, and
we're going to pull in the crazy.
I mean, the question is, how do you know how much is which? But and by the way, a lot of it is not all that competitive. Anyway, SP Futures up 16, NASDAQ is up 95. We had a couple days down, but now we're going to go back the other way. Buy the dip, and Bitcoin's making a little bit of a bounce here too. So all is well, evidently. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Lower North Bay Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 17, NASDAQ Futures up 96. We've been kind of percolating along here most of the morning. We're up a little last night, and we're kind of following through. Over in Europe, we've got unbelievable. DAX up 100 points, 0.4%. FTSE up 17.2%. CAC around up 15.9%. Bayer shares pop 11% after Trump administration backs curbing of Roundup lawsuits. I'll tell you what, this guy is busy getting his nose in every one of these things. What does he know about Roundup lawsuits? Anyway, just saying. I guess he wants to control everything. Nikkei up 17 cents. Let's call that one flat. Hang Seng up 61.2%. Shanghai down 16.4%. So not much. South Korea auto stocks rise after U.S. Commerce Secretary confirms tariff lowered to 15%. Gee, did somebody in Washington buy South Korea auto stocks before they did that? Hell, I believe in the absolute worst of these people. I don't know why, but I am. 10-year up 1 basis point, 4.11. Interest rates ran up quite a bit yesterday. We'll see if they haven't come down today. They're only up 0.1, though. But we're up to 4.11 on the 10-year, which is a little higher than we have been in a while. Oil, down 19 cents, 59.13. Still right around this 58 to 62 range. Brent down 24 cents, 62.93. Natural gas down 2 cents, 4.98. Hal, remind me to ask you, what about oil next year, oil stocks? We got a lot of people that wanted to be in them this year. Now I think they all want to bail. Gold down 35 bucks, still 42.39. Silver down 99 cents, 58.14. Foreign exchange, the euro's back up over 116, 116.1. It was under 116 for a while. British pound 132.01. It was under 132 for a while. So we got a little strengthening of those and weakening of the dollar. Crypto up 1,900 bucks. It was up 2,500 a minute ago. It's 87,388. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Is this going to go all the way to April? We have to go to... Take Stocks and Jocks to Arizona or someplace?
Oh, my God. We don't know, Chief. It's currently 21 degrees right now with a high of 25. Not looking too good right now. Very cold with times of clouds and sun today. Overnight snow might cause slippery conditions even today. So watch out for that. Tonight will be cloudy and cold, breezy late, and a low of 20 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 46 degrees right now with a high of 70. Mostly sunny and pleasant. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 46 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Iman Kennedy from Monroe's, 27 minutes. We're looking at 46 minutes inbound Edens from Lane Cook, Eisenhower from Wolf, 48 minutes, 38 minutes inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, and then Stevenson from 24 to the Dan Ryan, 43 minutes. Let's talk sports real quick. For NHL, we got Blackhawks at Golden Knights today at 9 p.m. For the NBA, we got Bulls barely losing to Magic, 120 to 125 yesterday, and Suns beat Lakers, 125 to 108. Lastly, NFL Week 14, this Thursday, December 4th, we got Cowboys at Lions, 7:15 p.m. and Sunday, December 7th, Bears at Packers, 3:25 p.m. and Rams at Cardinals, 3:25 p.m. as well. Back over to you guys.
So the Bulls, how are they doing with that Ole defense? That's their style.
Old lady defense?
Ole. Like you see the bull. The
oh! You said old lady.
No, well, same thing. Ole defense. Oh.
Well, isn't that kind of like the defense of the NBA nowadays where they just let people... I mean, you got four people camped outside the three-point line. Yeah. You got one guy driving the lane, and he kicks it out to some three-point shooter who knocks down a three.
God, is that disgusting to watch?
It's not fun. I can't watch it. Yeah.
I was just thinking when I talked about the Arizona thing. Ricky, I could use your opinion on this. What if I were to get some huge Airbnb and all the people on the show came down for a week and sat there and had cocktails every night and watched sports and argued with each other? Can you imagine what that week would be like?
It'd be fun.
You'd have to be the referee.
Yeah, I would say so. I would guess so. You know, it would get kind of heated at some point.
You'd have to pass out like 50-ounce boxing gloves or something.
Right. But that's what makes it fun.
It would be fun. All of a sudden, three drowned bodies would be in the pool again. I can't even imagine that. You guys all in the same room. Oh boy! Anyway, what when you see the stuff, you know, the Washington things, and I seem like I have more stuff to worry about than normal here now. Is it just me, or am I just getting crotchety? Now I'm worrying about Bitcoin. I don't know what the hell Bitcoin was. Now I got to worry about Bitcoin collapsing here, and all of a sudden some bank someplace I never heard of going under because they're into Bitcoin. There's always been enough variables in the market to worry about, and there are a couple.
I just think the government is supposed to be a stabilizer, and I don't think it is. I think it creates chaos. And all I got to do is look at a typical parking garage, right? Yeah. If people are driving through a parking garage too fast, they'll put in a speed bump. And then what happens is the people that are driving through the parking garage quickly, still, instead of hitting the speed bump really fast, they go around the speed bump. And that's exactly what government does. It creates all these speed bumps. In Salt Lake City, they have this road called 700 East, and it's like five lanes north and south. It's just a regular street, you know, through Salt Lake City, but it's five lanes wide. It's really massive. And what Salt Lake City does is it puts up this concrete barrier, this concrete median. And it does so in a way where when you want to turn left on like 1300 South, you have to wait in traffic for three or four lights to get in that left lane because they put this concrete median in there. Now, me and my little white Chevy Cobalt, I can't drive up on that median. But a 4x4 pickup truck does. And 4x4 pickup trucks drive on that concrete median to get that left turn lane because they made the queue really, really short. Or they take a left across those northbound lanes. They'll just drive over the median, right? So that's what government does. It puts up these barriers to herd us like sheep, and some people who are in a hurry to make money, who are in a hurry to get somewhere, they're going to go through or around those barriers. And that's what's going on right now, is you have all these barriers up everywhere, and the money in banking textbook we mentioned earlier, Michigan refers to mining these rules and regulations in financial markets as innovation.
Yeah,
that's what he called it. Right, mining the rules. And that's what happens when you have all these safeguards put in place. People with the most money and the most talented lawyers and tax accountants, they mine the rules and they benefit from it. And meanwhile, it acts as a barrier to entry for other people. All I'm saying is we should expect this, right?
Yeah, except I don't know if I was a huge fan of Thomas Jefferson, but he talks about, you know, a little revolution every now and then. You know, somewhere that becomes you can't let it go there. I mean, Carl talks all the time about what's going on in the medical community.
Yeah,
and he and I come at it from kind of different directions, but we get to the same place. You know, I don't really want to tell him that because we always like to debate.
I think what you're feeling, Tom, what I'm feeling, what you're feeling, we're feeling Marx's. We're not Marxist, but we're feeling Marx's rage.
Yeah,
that's what everybody's feeling. That's why people in New York City voted for a Marxist, a communist, because we're all feeling this rage. We're feeling the rage of Marx because Marx grew up in a world of state created and protected monopolies.
Yeah,
for the
essentially
elites.
Extreme crony capitalism.
Extreme crony capitalism.
But all you have to do, I mean, because maybe it's because of, you know, we don't, our professors haven't been good enough. Oh, sorry. All you have to do is get a bunch of, how am I going to say this without being political? All you have to do is get a bunch of right wingers in the room. And some left wingers too, right wingers in the room, and say, this crap with the medical community is wrong. We can't afford it.
Yeah.
You want socialized medicine? Not one person there can even define socialism for me.
They can't even. So
all you have to do is to the right is say, oh, what do you want to be, socialist? Okay, no, that's not what I want to be. I don't want to be crony capitalist. I want something to be competitive. And I'm always getting accused of wanting to be socialist. How does somebody who traded on trading floor for 20 years, the ultimate in capitalism, free market capitalism, how could you ever be accused of being a socialist? Yeah. I don't.
You know, I used to think this world government movement, WEF, or the way we set up trade policies that seems to gut the middle class in America and ship factories and jobs overseas. I used to think it was kind of like a world communist kind of movement where they're redistributing wealth, not at the individual level, but at the nation level. I used to think it was a communist move, but I think what it really is, it's they use communist socialist rhetoric to play on the heartstrings of people.
Yep. Without a doubt.
The real purpose is to usher in an old Europe style, old Eastern Europe style mercantilism, corporatism, whatever you want to call it. That's what the real goal is. They want us in chains. They want us regular people, us commoners. They want to restore the serfdom, the feudalism system of old Europe, where there's a few really well funded elites that basically run the world.
Funny you
and
should,
that's what it is. It's a world. It's either going to be run at a federal level in D.C., or it's going to be run at an international level with like the U.N. or NATO. That's exactly what's going on.
Well, you know, it's funny. Were you ever a Trekkie, Star Trek dude?
Oh yeah, I loved it. Yeah, I loved. Well,
remember the part where the goofy guy Q sent the Enterprise like 90 bazillion light years away, and. And then they met. They made the first time they saw the Borg, who was basically kicking ass in, you know, galaxy over or something. And they said, "I'm going to show you your future if you don't prepare for it."
Yeah.
And then he spun them back the other way, and eventually the Borg made it there, and they kicked the Borg's ass after a while. But my buddy Dr. J, and I'm thankful to him, dragged me over to Europe with him to do all this consulting in probably 1991. And we went to Credit Anstalt in Vienna, and we were at the dear departed Dresdner Bank in Germany, and we were there maybe a weekish, and I came away absolutely. I felt like Picard after seeing the Borg. I'm like, I don't want to go here. The company's stock were 85% owned by the banks. The government controlled the banks. If you were a young guy, no way on God's green earth could you start your own law firm, your own brokerage firm. It was all controlled by a few people, a few families. If you kept your nose clean and you worked your way up, by the time you were 40 or 50, you had money, and a lot of the young girls were going walking down the street with the old guys because they had the money. And I love the people. I looked at the system and I go, God, this better not be us.
Yeah.
And we're heading right there. And I got this, you know, 30-some years ago, I got this view, and I've been fighting against it the whole way, Hal, and I'm losing the whole way. The exchange floors went from went from people, you know, bargaining to five people that send the stuff to the floor. This is not my world, and I see it just keep going on and on. And every administration's worse. Whatever it happens to be, whether it's Democrat or Republican, everyone's worse. These guys are worse than Biden. Biden was worse than the guy before him. They all are heading down this road. A few people want to control everything. In some place, somewhere. But you run into the spot, and this is what Carl's always talking about. He thinks, you know, he's going to be early because he's a regular person. You look at the numbers that he brings out and his medical stuff, we can't afford it. Now, this particular administration says, okay, we'll just stop funding the stuff for poor people. And by the way, we never met them. If they die, so what? I mean, I know that's not what they individually would tell you. I don't really care if somebody dies. But the fact is, that's the policy, or appears to me. Now, that's a policy. But I don't think it really makes any difference. If we're charging $50,000 for a chemo treatment that's $2,000 over in India, I don't think we've reached the point where regular people can't afford it. Man. We're way past that. Now, what is it? Do we really need a $50,000 car median price? What the bleep? We can't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't know. We're heading down a road where at some point, I don't know if people are just going to be sheep forever. It's happened so gradually. You know, did you ever see the what was it, Mr.?
Honestly, I think it's just these people given the changes in the banking regulations that we've been talking about, the monetary policy regulations, that is turbocharging the Cantillon effect?
Yeah.
I just see it as they're just flipping the bird at the public. That's how I see it.
Absolutely. I mean,
it's unapologetic flipping the bird at.
Hell, you mentioned the banking stuff.
Yeah.
And we've talked about that now 3-4 days that you've been at. Flip to the medical stuff that I talk about a lot with Carl. You can't tell me it's not the exact same subject.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Yeah.
Few people. The other people.
Yeah. When I developed the health economics course that I taught for about 3 semesters in a row, it just freaking blew my mind. The American Medical Association in 2009 had issued apologies to Black America because in the early days of it, where it got the ability to license medical schools and doctors, it purposely closed Black medical colleges, medical schools, and it limited licenses to basically white Christian males. Why? Maybe they were racist, but maybe they also wanted they got the star bellies. They got the star belly. Other people don't. The star belly being white male Christian, medically trained at a premier medical school. If you only license them, there is now a scarcity of doctors nationwide, and that drives that artificial scarcity, pushes wages up that demand curve, that labor demand curve. And so they get these incredible salaries.
So they
apologize to the Black community in America.
I know it bothers the hell out of you when I say this, little Milty. When Milton Friedman always had two examples of stuff not being competitive.
Yeah.
One of them was cab medallions, and the other was medical schools. So you are now on the same one as your dad. He would always talk about how do you let doctors decide how many med schools there are. He goes, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard.
It is, yeah.
And but it's still that way today, right?
Well, there are seeds of hope, though. I read an article. I shared this article with my health economics students. Where in Washington State, they're waiving for lawyers. They're waiving bar exams to increase diversity in the legal field.
So now you want dumb lawyers?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is the entrance requirements into a law school, the LSAT, does the LSAT really predict how good a lawyer going to be? I don't think it does.
Well, if you don't know anything about the law, you're not going to be too good.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, you know, my friend Peggy, who I went to high school with and was friends with her up through the 2000s, I've lost touch with her. But she was telling me when I was in the Navy, she was going to college to become a nurse. And in her cohort of students, the Nursing Association in Oregon added algebra as a course requirement for being a nurse. And this is before I had any
economic training. Somebody's got to be able to send out the bills and add them up.
I know, but what I'm saying is I wasn't an economist yet. And I looked at that. I told her, well, that's just a way to keep the number of people wanting to become a nurse small, so you create, you know, less nurses, which means each nurse is now more valuable, and these nurses that are basically writing the rules of who can be licensed and who can't, now they have this smaller number of nurses, which pushes their salaries up. That's what I told her before I had any economics courses.
Who's the control and the
This is back in like 1996.
Well, it's been going on for.
I said that.
It's been going on since Troy, for God's sake.
Yeah.
What?
Tennessee and Utah, they're pretty Republican states. But if you look at the licensing laws, they're pretty onerous. In Utah, in order to be an African hair braider, you have to do 2,000. I'm not sure if it's still the case, but in like 2018. The rules were that you had to do 2,000 hours of training to braid African women's hair. And the 2,000 hours of training had nothing to do with how to braid hair. It was just a way to keep people out of that market to make the salaries higher.
Well, you're not a pet sort of dude, are you?
When I was a kid, we had lots of dogs because they seem to die very rapidly on our farm. They get run over by a tractor, so all that trauma, you know, I stopped being a pet owner in my mid-30s.
Well, some of the biggest moves in prices in the last 10 years here, I know this because Audrey's a super pet person, and I had my dog Scruff for a while. I'm going to say the amount of money increases in vet care, and try and get in a veteran school, a veterinarian school.
Yeah,
you can't get in one.
What I find really surprising is people are. When I was a kid, if a dog got, you know, sick, and this might sound heartless, but if a dog got sick, we didn't spend $8,000 on a vet visit. The dog was just put to sleep, and that happened a lot when I was a kid. We didn't spend
It's changed, but now people
we fed the dog.
Dog's a family member
the dog
now.
Very well, but if it got ran over by a car, we weren't going to have surgery on the dog. It just got put to sleep.
Well, that's the way you farm guys are, you know.
Yeah, I know.
City people, it's a member of the family.
Well, there's a lot of stray dogs and cats in rural areas, so there's always a pet around the corner.
Scruff was on Alzheimer's drugs, my terrier dog.
Really?
And they actually helped, believe it or not.
Wow.
He was still kind of wandering around, so I figured, plus it was $100 a month. This was 15 years ago. And I go, well, this isn't helping him, so I took him off. It did help. Poor little guy.
Really?
Oh, yeah, You don't want a terrier on Alzheimer's because all they do is go forward. If you walk behind a door, they'll just stand there. They don't back up. They're not like a regular dog. Terriers love you in their own way, but they're not. I mean, he used to hop up on the sofa when I wasn't looking because he didn't want to look out the window, right? So all of a sudden his back legs, or not so, not all of a sudden, his back legs get to a point where he, he couldn't hop up there. So I go, Scruff. I pull the cushion off next to it, and I go, here, hop up here and then walk over there. He looks at me like, but I get up over here. Why are you moving that cushion over there? I mean, because Scruff, I want you to be able to...
Dogs are funny, man.
A poodle would immediately hopped up the other side and walked over.
A cat would have just looked at you cross-eyed and walked away.
Yeah, he just said, what are you doing? Anyway, what is the end game with this? I mean, are we going to go broke because of the medical stuff or all the... The things we're talking about with the banks, when you have small people not getting loans, and I can't wait till the next election. Swinging idiot's going to talk about helping the middle class.
Tom.
Sure, it's
intentional.
I just think it's intentional.
Why? They want us to be serfs. They want to crush us.
Well,
they want to be the aristocrats. They want to be the nobles.
Competition is the greatest thing for every other industry but mine, because in my industry, it's cutthroat competition, right?
Well, that's when I stopped. When I realized that. You know, I grew up in Idaho. In Idaho, like 60% of the population, maybe it was higher when I was a kid, were Republican. And I figured, yeah, you know, pro-business policies are better than pro-labor policies because pro-labor policies will drive the business out of the state. Let's have some pro-business policies so the business stays in the state and continues to hire people. That's what I thought. And the Republicans always talked of free markets. But here's the
But
here's
they're
the
not rub. Really free.
They're not free markets.
No.
Republicans don't want free markets. They want free market. If they're a business person, they want free markets in terms of the things they purchase.
Yeah, oh yeah,
they don't want free markets in terms of the things they sell.
Well, that's a free.
That is the distinction between a free market, truly free market person, and a Republican, right? And that's why I can't be a Republican. Now, I'm not a Democrat because I don't think a monopoly, a labor monopoly. If people want to form a union, fine. But you can't also have coercion of the state forcing a company to hire that unionized labor. If you want to form a union, be my guest.
Well, a regular union, I mean, you know, my Pullman days, a regular union, all you're really doing is the labor in a place, which is valuable, is fighting with the management over how you cut up the pie, right?
Yeah. Well, my business professor, when I was a freshman at Lewis Clark State College, he'd always say, if you have a union, then you deserve it because you don't treat people right.
Well, that's probably the truth.
And I agree with that, right? If you treat people poorly, you're going to end up having a union.
Well, look at what started the unions. People like George Pullman.
Yeah.
People like the coal miners. And if you lived to be 30, I was being nice to you. I mean, that's how unions started, right?
Well, but unions have a racist history. If you look at the cigar boxes, if you look at the cigar industry of California, and just look at the cigar boxes, the racist imagery is mind-blowing, because you have white males running down black cigar makers and Chinese cigar makers. I mean, it's overtly racist. So labor unions in America started out as white-only, white male-only labor, keeping out, just like the American Medical Association, keeping out people of color, keeping out Jewish people, keeping out women. That's where the labor union movement started.
I read this thing from Quora. It was about what is wrong with America is Trump. And the guy writes back, and he's somebody from Britain or someplace, and he goes, it's not Trump, it's America. He goes, it's the most racist place it's ever lived. Because you started with the pilgrims. They didn't want anything to do with anybody else. If you weren't a pilgrim, you weren't part of that religion.
That view of history is very sketchy, because it assumes that all pilgrims are the same and all Native Americans are the same, and they weren't.
There were laws that prevented pilgrims from marrying Native American people. I didn't say I wrote the article. I'm telling you what the guy said. He said, look at the history. Well, then you got the Indians. We got to get rid of them. Yeah. Then you've got the blacks. We didn't do so hot with them. Now, by the way, we had the Chinese build the railroads. Then we didn't want any part of them.
But the Irish,
they had red hair, so they weren't really white. they were something else. They talked differently. We're not really happy with anybody who ever came here, have we? Yeah. Look, we did the Japanese. The people who were here and never.
I think the racist institutions in America are the ones where people like the American Medical Association can discriminate.
Well, we're doing the same thing now. Doing the same thing now with immigrants.
Yeah,
we don't want them here. We don't need them. Get them the hell out of here. I mean, it's kind of. But it's also. You know, I guess somewhat natural.
I'm going to say this, Tom. Racism is a problem every part of the planet.
Sure it is.
When my buddy Mark, a fellow professor of mine, went to Mexico on his honeymoon, he stayed in this, pay one price and have all the accoutrements all in, resort in Mexico. He said when he went there, he noticed that the lighter your skin, the closer you were to the customer. The further away from the customer, the darker your skin.
Oh, yeah.
So racism is a universal truth.
No. Just people are afraid of something that's not like them.
Yeah.
You know what's weird? And on this wacky, I was telling you about my German trip. So we go to this street fair with all the girls from the bank and the guys in the bank, too. And the scary part of this is, not one of them was a trader, hell. Every single one was an employee.
Yeah.
And I was a trader. I mean, the thing about you have to be a person that likes that. I never wanted to be in a softball league where we won every game and everybody was a bunch of chumps. I didn't want to play against Jerry's kids.
Yeah.
I want to play in a league where if we played well, we won. If we didn't, we lost. Because that's the way sport is, right?
I mean, real sport. It's kind of funny when you watch the college football team like Alabama playing Charlton State.
They played Eastern Illinois.
They're literally celebrating scoring a touchdown against that defense.
Yeah.
Dude, you should have scored 50 touchdowns.
Yeah.
Not just one.
But I mean, when I went to the trading floor,
I never wanted to play against lesser talent.
I didn't want any advantage on the trading floor.
Yeah.
That was every day was competition. I loved it.
Yeah.
What I wouldn't give to one more day back there. I don't want to do one, but going up against competitors is the forging iron. Yeah.
Iron sharpens iron. You want to go up against people who are smarter and better than you, because you want to get better.
Yeah.
And people who are afraid of the competition, they seek out government protections from that competition.
Everybody else, other people
that happens in labor, and that happens in business, and that happens in politics.
Everybody wants an angle. Everybody needs an angle. But I guess it reaches the point. We haven't really, well, we did it once in the 20s here. I don't want that to happen. What happens when a year after Carl says everything's going to fall apart? He's not wrong. What happens when all of a sudden we're talking 50% of the government spending is making up new money? I mean, at some level here, there's going to be, I mean, I don't, if this, and I hope this tariff, I think those things are horrible, but all of a sudden, with this great new bill where he lowered the taxes for his buddies. I don't, if all of a sudden there's no tariffs, where's this deficit going to go? Anybody doesn't think there's not going to be a tax increase in their future, boy, I got a bridge for you for sale.
Yeah. Well, either we're going to have to raise taxes or we're going to cut government spending, neither of which is going to happen because Republicans won't give and the Democrats won't give. So neither of that's going to happen, so the debt's going to get worse. And it's going to get to the point where...
What are we going to do? Not pay off?
The money, they're going to inflate, which they've been doing, right? That's a tax. The people that touch it first don't pay the tax. The people that touch that newly printed money last pay the inflation tax.
Without a doubt.
So that is going to further drive a wedge between those paying the inflation tax and those not. And that's going to increase the rage, and you're going to see a Marxist rage, and it's going to split the country in two. You'll have the Marxist rage increasing the power of socialists in the cities, and you'll have
but they won't really be socialists. They'll be branded as socialists.
Well, yeah, I know, but what I'm saying is you'll have the cities going that direction, and I think you'll have the counties going the opposite
direction. Well, I'll tell you what.
What the Trump
policies is doing to some farmers in this country, I'm not so sure you can count on them.
You're just going to fracture the country.
Hey, speaking of fracturing,
it happened in Rome.
Which one of your teams? Who's your team? Washington or Washington State?
Washington State.
So what's going on with those guys? Are you sending them 20?
Well,
million?
They got a new conference. It's no longer the Tupac.
What is it now?
Tupac. Hey, we won the Pac-12 this year.
The Pac-2?
Both teams ended up 1-1, but we won the tiebreaker because we had the better record and we had more points for than points against. So
are you ponying up $1 million for some new coach they're going to hire?
Well, they got a pretty good coach. It's just a matter of if they can keep him.
Now, who's
Jimmy
gonna be,
Rogers from South Dakota State?
So who's going to be in the conference next year?
It's going to be the state colleges like Utah State, San Diego State, Fresno State, Texas State, the state colleges out west for the most part, the big state colleges.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. So right. every member of the new Pac-12 is like Oregon State, Washington State, Utah State, San Diego State.
One of these days, next week maybe, I never could quite get the difference between Michigan and Michigan State in terms of funding and everything. Maybe next week you can give me a 2-minute rendition.
Oh, did you hear that the Oregon State coach, Jonathan, got fired at Michigan State? I think he's going to pull a Riley and end up back at Oregon State when Oregon State loses.
Well, they just hired a guy from Northwestern to get tossed because of the hazing stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Michigan State.
They got rid of Jonathan.
But what is the – we got a second. What is the difference between the funding or the panache of Washington versus Washington State? I mean, is Washington...
Well, Washington is in the Seattle-Tacoma metro area, and Washington State's in a town of about 20,000 people.
But, I mean, is...
So Washington State are the cousins, the country cousins, and University of Washington are the elite, rich people from...
Okay, so it's sort of like Michigan and Michigan State, even though it's...
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
All right, bud. SP Futures up 23, NASDAQ Futures up 128. Have a nice weekend. Hey, if you, I'll dig around for some Stigler stuff if you want me to. Just let me know.
Oh, yeah, just... Send it to me an email. I'd love to read it through it.
You know what? Next week I will regale you with how he could change corruption in Chicago. Somebody actually asked him that, and he had an interesting question. Answer. Let's talk about it next week. Ricky, nice job. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.